This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Michael Martone is my guest today on the program. He's a Midwesterner, a native of Fort Wayne. We'll talk about the Midwest and the people who live here. Martone's latest book, a collection of essays, is called The Flatness and Other Landscapes. Let me quote from the book's description. From describing mechanized cow milking to relating the similarities between Indianapolis and the Greek city of Sparta, Martone subtly connects different cultures, times, and stories to depict the real and metaphorical landscapes of America's heartland. Michael Martone, born and grown in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's the author of numerous books, fiction and nonfiction. Listeners, I encourage your telephone calls this afternoon. As he and I talk, I hope you'll join the discussion. The telephone number is in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Michael Martone is a professor of English and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa. The Flatness and Other Landscapes is published by the University of Georgia Press. Michael, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Great.
Good. So what's Tuscaloosa like?
Well, it's not like this. It's in the middle of a pine forest. When I drive north from Tuscaloosa in the south, it's right about Carbondale. You know, you come back up onto the prairie and that opens up again. So Tuscaloosa is quite closed in.
Closed in. So it's quite different, too, from your hometown, Fort Wayne.
Yes. Yes, it is. Very different. It's interesting when you think about the Midwest. Midwest is a sort of region. The South has been doing regionalism for a lot longer. They're quite conscious of region, and it's a quite different sort of sense of that place than the Midwest as a region.
Yeah. I think the Midwest kind of has a Rodney Dangerfield feel to it in terms of, you know, we don't get much respect, and we don't sometimes respect ourselves.
Well, I think it's an interesting paradox in the Midwest that I think if you are a Midwesterner, you feel simultaneously that you're in the middle of everything. You're at the heart of everything, the middle of everything, but also that you're on the periphery of everything. And so you have these conflicting feelings of being the center of the target, at the same time you're just on the margin.
Hmm.
And I think that is unique. I don't think other regions have that same kind of conflict.
Hmm. In the essay in The Flatness titled Stories We Tell Ourselves, you write, the stories we tell ourselves create the very space that we as a group, any group, inhabit. Places made by story. And later in that same essay you write, stories are viral. And also, in the stories we tell ourselves, we tell ourselves. When did you begin to see the deep connection between story and place?
Well, as I say in that same essay, I think it was fortuitous that Edith Hamilton, who is famous for writing the book Mythology, that schoolboys and girls still read about Greek mythology, grew up in my hometown, and I used to play in the Hamilton Park, and I grew up on land that was owned by her family. And when I made that connection, that all these great stories about this place that I had never been, only in reading, when I made that connection, that I know these things because a girl from my hometown wrote them. As far as I knew, she could have made them up, really. I think that was, and then I also discovered that Athens in the Golden Age was about the size of Fort Wayne is now, and I thought, well, we have stories, they have stories, why are we taking these stories as seriously? So,
One of the stories you tell in that essay, there are so many layers of story in that essay, is about teaching at Iowa State, teaching a course in contemporary rural and agricultural literature.
It was great. It was terrific.
And one of your students said, why should we be studying this?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I couldn't believe that she did that. She was from as they love to say at Iowa State, from a small rural community. And I asked her, well, what should we be studying? And honest to God, she did say, we should be studying something important like the Greek myths. And that is the moment. You know, I said, well, you know, where did Odysseus go after 20 years of being away from home when he came back and he had to hide out in Ithaca, and they didn't remember. And I said, well, they hung out with his friend, the hog farmer, and and most of the kids in the class were from hog farms, and the dog was on the dung pile. So these were. You know, I said, these are just people not that unlike you. That's why we study Greek mythology. They have stories and you have stories.
Yeah. That idea of studying something that's important, like the Greeks.
Right.
I wonder if kids in Iowa or in Illinois think that that's what's important, because in part we go back to that idea of discounting ourselves in our stories,
mm-hmm.
and thinking that we're living on a cruddy old hog farm or mm-hmm. in a small town.
Well, I mean, that's why universities in the Midwest and other places, that's why we have composition programs. I know if there are students listening, you know, why do I have to take freshman composition? I'm going to be an engineer or a farmer. When in fact, what composition, one of its purposes is to actually equip people with the very language to understand and comprehend and to fight back against all these other competing stories, and especially when it comes to the use of rhetoric in politics and in advertising. That's what advertising does. You live in the middle of nowhere. You are nothing. You're not worth anything. Buy this makeup. Buy this record. You'll feel better. But composition, the study of rhetoric, you know, you understand how those stories are being really used against you. And composition, I hope, English studies, I hope, equip students in the Midwest, you know, with a way to fight back against those things.
That course you were teaching at Iowa State, Contemporary Rural and Agricultural Literature, do you teach it at Alabama?
I haven't taught it at Alabama, but I did teach it in Syracuse, New York. I taught for 5 years at Syracuse University, and that was quite interesting, different. In Iowa, all of my students, not all of them were on farms, but a lot of them, of course, knew what farms were. In Syracuse, I had 50 students, all of them from Long Island. None of them had grown up on farms. And interesting enough, hardly any, I think maybe two out of the 50 were from families who had their own businesses. So I asked them the first day to draw a farm. And this was in the early 90s. And they drew a picket fence, a farmhouse, a windmill, a mow barn with a silo, a multi-animal farm. And then they also drew a picture of a farmer that had overalls, a straw hat, and something, you know, between the lips, like a, you know, a straw or something. And, you know, the class for them then became trying to break down the idea that this is not the way it is now. But then why is that myth, why is that story, why is that vision of the farm and agriculture, why is that so compelling and important, and should it be something we aspire to, or is it an idea that really the time has come and gone?
And any insights into those questions from your students?
Well, the class in both cases, in both in Iowa and in Syracuse, often finally came back to education and to notions of knowledge and how, and especially since one of the authors we studied was Wendell Berry, especially the notion between a kind of general knowledge about the world and a very specific, specialized notion. And that was in play, of course, because they're in universities that the university's business is to make you a specialist. I would say to my students at Iowa State, you know, I could take your agriculture courses. I could take agronomy. I could get an A. And they said, well, yeah, we know that. and I said, and I could pass the degree you're going to pass and get my degree in agronomy. I could do it. And I said, that would make me a farmer, right? And they said, well, no. And then I said, well, then, what does it need? Well, you have to, you know, grow up on a farm and work on a farm and know it in a different way. And then I'd say, well, then why are you here? If what you want to do is farm, why are you? And so those were interesting questions, I think, for them to tackle in Iowa, especially.
Mm-hmm. And in Syracuse?
In Syracuse, In Syracuse, it was more a sort of an incredible moment happened when we were doing Mary Swander's book. Do you know Mary Swander's book, Driving the Body Back?
No.
It's a book of poems, a linked group of poems. A woman and her aunt have the woman's mother's body in the back of the station wagon. She's died in Iowa City, and they're driving the body back to the family to the family graveyard in western Iowa. And it becomes a kind of Irish wake. And so each poem is about all the dead members of the family that they relive as they drive. And so I was saying to the students in Syracuse, do you understand what's going on here? This woman's body is in the back. And, oh, yeah, yeah, we get that. He said, but they said, can you do that? And I said, well, what do you mean? Can you have a body in the back of your car? And I said, well, sure, it's your body. And so then I started asking them, I said, how many of you were born at home? Well, none of them. How many of you were educated at home? None of them. How many of you have taken care of your own sick? None of them. How many of you raise your own food? None of them. How many cook your own food? Some of them, but not a lot. How many of you have, dinner with your family? Well, of course, they weren't anymore. And so I finally got to the real existential question, what is a family then? If you don't take care of your dead, you don't take care of your sick, you don't educate your family, what is the purpose of family? And they were quite struck by how the knowledge that very early in their lives, mm-hmm. these specialists then had already intervened, you know, from the point of their birth. There were specialized knowledge interventions that had continued all the way into college where they were today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm reminded of a passage in one of the essays in The Flatness where you write about all the things that we leave and how so many people leave the Midwest, mm-hmm. but the bodies come back.
Mm-hmm. In that one, I think, too, I think there is... Well, the leaving and the coming, I think, as I've thought about it, there is this huge migration in this country that sort of goes completely unreported in a lot of ways. The largest Polish city is Chicago. The largest Arab city is Detroit. And, you know, that sense of immigration is much more visible to people. But our immigrations were never outside of the country. And so this mass of people sort of moving around was another sort of subject to the book. And that was really the sort of drama of America, you know, this desire to stay and this demand to move. I think in another author we studied was Wendell Berry, and that's really important to him. You know, how does one stay when the sort of cultural landscape is rigged to move around? And I'm of course caught in that paradox. I write about one particular specific place, but at the same time, my life has been one of constant movement. And what the university's paradox is, especially the state universities were established to help people remain in place, but in fact, by granting them degrees, they put wheels on people and make them move. I mean, that you have to move. There's no other reason to go to the university and come back with that degree.
Mm. So. There are so many differences place to place within this place we call the Midwest. In the book, The Flatness and Other Landscapes, there's a story, there's an essay, which is a tale of two cities, Riverside, Iowa, and Kelowna, uh-huh. Iowa. Tell us about these two places, Steve Miller and James T. Kirk.
Yeah. When I was in Iowa and when I was thinking about these things really actively, it was in the 1980s, a really depressing time economically and sort of mentally in Iowa. And there was another big transformation going on in Iowa, and that meant that a lot of farms were closing, were being consolidated. Small towns were having to rethink what they were. And one of the things I think that happened in the 80s was this notion that we would replace a kind of productive economy with a recreative economy. There was a great New Yorker cartoon at the time. These sort of yuppie couple sitting in a restaurant having a nice meal, and it was this sort of brick background, obviously, you know, some factory industrial space, and the caption was something like, we know we really made it as a country when we start taking restaurants and turning them into factories. And so there was that sense all through that decade of these schemes, because all of the old economy was dying away. And Steve Miller in Riverside, who had watched Star Trek on television, heard that Captain Kirk was from Iowa, but not a specific town, and he wrote and actually got permission to proclaim his town, as Riverside, Iowa, as the future birthplace of Captain James T. Kirk. And this was supposed to, of course, bring in all this money that was being lost in the farm economy and in the old construction economy that was there. And of course, the irony was that the town was so depressed it probably wouldn't even make it into the next century as a town at all in time to be the place for the birth. And then right next to it was Kelowna, Iowa, which was an Amish town, which looked, of course, like a 19th century town, and it was thriving because the economics of despair and disaster that was happening, they could avoid because they never went into debt. They never invested in incredibly heavy equipment. And so they were actually doing quite well. And here this town was alive and the town of the future was not. So the essay was really about kinds of nostalgia, I think, and that we often are very critical as a culture about nostalgia for the past. You know, farms aren't like that anymore. But we have a harder time recognizing a nostalgia for the future. And I think that Steve Miller had that nostalgia for the future, as a lot of political leaders did. You know, if we only get that next pesticide, if we only get that genetic stuff figured out, then all our problems will be taken care of. Sure, our dirt is eroding down the Mississippi, but we're going to fix that. You know, it's up there in the future someplace. So.
It's interesting because reading that essay, I was reminded of the little town in southern Illinois, Metropolis.
Oh, yeah, Metropolis. Yeah.
Where they have the phone booth and they have a statue of Superman there. And even here in Urbana, you know, we have celebrated the birthday of HAL, the infamous computer from Kubrick's 2001,
well,
A Space Odyssey.
It is an interesting thing how creation, in a way, is being replaced by recreation. In Bloomington, Indiana, where I got my degree, you know, you can now get a PhD in touristic studies. You know, that is, as we call it now, an industry. And what is that industry but actually going to these various, it's related to stories too, of taking a place and actually endowing it with stories and trying to profit off of them. Another one of the essays in the book deals with that, where Grant Wood's, the house that Grant Wood used to paint the American Gothic, the model of that house, there were people living on public assistance in the house, but more and more the state and the city, in their depressed condition, wanted people to visit the house, to come off the interstate and pay a couple bucks to stand in front of the house like the American Gothic. And yet there was still life there. And so they were trying to work out getting those people out of there because that was like real, and get back to the sort of facade of entertainment as a way of generating money. And actually, all, of course, it does is sort of move money around.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Michael Martone is our guest this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about the essays in his new book, The Flatness and Other Landscapes. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your telephone calls are welcome this afternoon. Questions, comments, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, to give listeners a sense of your writing and of your ideas of place, maybe you would read from this book. The title essay maybe would be a great place to begin, which is where the collection begins. It's an essay called The Flatness.
They are thinking about northern Ohio, about Indiana, about the long stretch through Illinois and on into Iowa. It is flat. The geometry of the field suggests a map as large as the thing it represents. The squared township roads score the axes of coordinates. The cusp of trees on the horizon, the water tower, the elevator or tokens slid there, representing ground taken and held. The only dimension marked by Z is the state of dreaming as they drive on the interstates meandering in tangents that seek what the builders of railroads who were here with the rulers first called a water level route. There are places in the Midwest that are not like this, the limestone hills, the lush bluffs, the forest lakes and sand dunes, the rills and knobs and kettles. But the people who know the place only by driving through it know the flatness. They skim along a grade of least resistance. The interstate defeats their best intentions. I see them starting out big-hearted and romantic from the density and variety of the East to see just how big this country is. They are all well-read. They see an expanse as they come out of the green hills, and the vista opens up, a true vision now, so vast that at night as they drive, the vastness can be merely suggested by the farmyard lights that demonstrate plain geometry by their rearranging patterns. And in the dawn around Sandusky, they have had enough, and they hunker down and drive, looking for mountains they know are out there somewhere. They cannot see what is all around them now. A kind of blindness afflicts them, a pathology of the path, the flatness.
Hmm. Flatness can be exhausting, can it?
Oh, I think so. The essay goes on to sort of talk about the sort of, if you are raised, I think, in this landscape, you become sensitive in a different way to... to a different sense of the thrilling nature of a hill. in Fort Wayne, as I mentioned in the essay, Fort Wayne is on a continental divide. Water in the eastern part of town, if rain fell in the eastern part of town, it eventually worked its way to the Atlantic. But on the western side of town, it eventually goes to the Gulf of Mexico. But the difference in elevation is a matter of 10 or 20 feet. And that's why Fort Wayne's nickname is the Summit City, because it was the highest point on the canal. And that's why there were so many forts there, because during the time of water travel, that was the portage between the two water basins, and it was fought over a lot until that was no longer strategic. But it was just a matter of 10 feet. That's the mountain. And then you think of the other continental divide out west. You know, there you can see it, but here it's pretty subtle.
Yeah. The photograph that you've chosen for the dust jacket is...
Well, I should really say that the press chose it. I mean, that was a wonderful surprise, because I said, I'd love a picture of the Midwest someplace, and they found one right from around here.
Yeah, the photographer is Larry Canfer,
mm-hmm.
who actually grew up in Portland, Oregon, or in the Oregon area.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And talking with him over the years... he's really come to love this landscape,
mm-hmm.
And he says that it continues to surprise him and delight mm-hmm. him, even though you have to develop an appreciation and an eye for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a theory about animals evolving, and you know, of course, in different landscapes, and how the eye itself evolves differently if one evolves in a plain as opposed to the forest. And there's that wonderful story. There was an old book called The Forest People by Turnbull. Do you know that book? It's a study of African pygmies who live in forests. And at one point, he takes them out to the plain, and these guys are looking, and they're saying, "Look at that! That ant is growing." And what it turns out to be, of course, is a rhinoceros in the distance coming toward them. And because they had never experienced a depth like that, they hadn't developed also our illusions, our lies that we have for depth perception. And so to them, it looked exactly like what it was, something very small growing large. And they hadn't been able to cognitively mm-hmm. figure it out yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is that. I think you do grow used to this new way of using your sight,
mm-hmm.
and for the for this part of the Midwest, this plain, I think it is thrilling to sort of grow into it.
Mm-hmm. Also, the distance is so tricky. In one of the essays you write about, you know, being in a part of the Midwest where you got to keep your eye on the odometer.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the only direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'll be lost.
I think it's just, back to an earlier thing, it's related here, is that, part of what makes the Midwest the Midwest is that Midwesterners all know that they're in the Midwest, but no one agrees where the Midwest is. There's this wonderful conference every year at Michigan State, Midwest Literature Association, and when people give papers at the conference, they all have to sort of start their paper by saying, this is what I mean by the Midwest. And and then they name the states that are in the Midwest. And it can go all the way from part of Colorado down to Oklahoma, up to Michigan and to Ohio. That's not my Midwest. So I, of course, state my terms, and I sort of make an argument about the township grid, even though most of the country, except for the old 13 colonies, were actually plated. It really took hold in the states that I think of as Midwestern, where you can really see those squares. And, of course, if you know about those squares, you in fact, really don't even need an odometer. You can just know that every 6 miles you're going to hit a major road, and every section, you'll know where the section lines are at 640 acres, and you'll, because they'll be switching from corn to soybeans, and you can actually make your own odometer and find, how many clicks down the road before you turn.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There's a couple of essays in the book where you go to farms, the hog farm, and then a dairy farm. What made you want to go and visit those places? And how long did you stay, and what did you learn?
Well, growing up in Fort Wayne, I mean, that's another one of my arguments for the Midwest, is that the Midwest is not agriculture. It is a combination of agriculture and industry. And so, of course, I'm more, because I'm from Indiana, lean more to that combination. That's what the middle is, I thought. But for my Iowa students, of course, it had to be farming, and it had to be corn farming. And growing up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which was an industrial Rust Belt city, I didn't know about farms, even though I was a Midwesterner. So I really did weasel my way onto their farms, because I was just like my Syracuse students who thought that farms looked like something out of the 1930s. I was amazed. I was amazed at what the landscape was. And just fascinating content. So I just went out, and because I wanted to visit and learn about this stuff, I said I would work and understand this. And so, I would end up driving tractors that cost more than my house. It was just an amazing journey for me.
Yet at the same time, there's this family that you visit. Don and Cheryl and their son Tom, mm-hmm. And this again is during
a hog
the,
farmer.
The time of the farm crisis of the 80s, and Tom says to you, "Well, we won't have to report any income this year."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just amazing.
He was then in a $2 million debt with his father, and he was 21 years old. And it is, as some of your listeners know, of course, an amazing sort of logic of debt and farming. Here he was, this young kid, and he had made that decision not to leave, but to actually return. He was farrowing 300 head of hogs, all indoors, all in the middle of winter. And who'd have thunk it? Back to something we said earlier, too, that's the one thing about the Midwest as well, is that when you said the bodies come back, the Midwest is so open and so visible, and yet it is also so hidden. The way we raise animals, the way we dispose of things, all of this stuff is so secret. People don't know about it. Only, less than 2% of America works on farms. No one knows what's out here. So even though it seems so open, so visible, it's completely obscured.
Yeah, it's invisible, but yet it's so physical.
Yeah, that's right. That's true, too. Yeah.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello. You sound like you're right there in the studio, so I'm wondering if you're in town and going to be doing a reading or something.
Great question.
Hang up and let you answer.
Okay. In fact, Michael is
here
in the flesh. Michael Martone is here, and later this afternoon he will be at the Illini Union Bookstore for a reading and books signing, and that is set for 4 p.m. this afternoon. And the Illini Bookstore, in case you don't know where it is, it's at 809 South Wright Street. It's right across the street from Urbana in Champaign.
I like that. I like those boundaries in the Midwest. They're just a line. You cross over, and then you're into something else. There's a wonderful line down in the South. It's called the Bug Line. Do you know about the Bug Line?
Mm-mm.
I live actually now below the Bug Line, and it is the line below which insects do not die in the winter. And so that was quite strange moving to the South, that that you would have crickets in the middle of January. There's that other great line you probably do know, you know, sort of further west of here, when you move from wetland farming to dryland farming, if you're driving from the west, you know, and you cross that line, all of a sudden your windshield's filled with, you know, the insects again as you cross out of the desert and into the...
That's interesting.
Yeah, all those sort of hidden boundaries.
It must be wild to hear crickets all the time.
Oh, it's very bizarre. the other interesting thing in the South is that I would wake up and I'd hear robins, and of course my instinct was to say, "Oh, spring is here." But then, this is where the robins go, and so spring arrives when you don't hear the robins because they've left for the north. So it was quite discombobulating.
Well, I keep waiting to hear. You know, here it's turned. We've had a long cold winter, and now suddenly it almost feels like it's
mm-hmm.
summer, and yet we haven't heard the crickets yet.
Uh-huh.
But the peonies are out, and the tulips are out, and I mean the peonies aren't blooming, but they're a foot and a half out of the ground.
Well, I like to garden, and I cannot grow peonies in the South, of course. But you can't grow peonies not because it gets too hot, but because you have to freeze the crowns. And so you can tell Midwesterners in the South because they're out there actually mulching in the winter with ice to keep the crowns frozen. So, but the peonies are just.
Yeah. I know I have friends in Texas who put tulips in the freezer.
Yeah,
the
to try to.
So they can have a little bit of home. Well, do you visit the countryside in Alabama?
I've begun to. I would really like to know about cotton farming and about peanut farming. But what's sort of missing in a way, what I like about the Midwest is that thing we were talking about earlier, the sort of hiddenness of the Midwest, the hiddenness in plain sight. Whereas the South, if anything, has to sort of struggle through all of its rather... what rambunctious history of being so Southern, you know, being so different, being so unreconstructed. So in a way, you don't have to travel as far or work as hard to find the South because, you know, it's sort of coming to us all now. I mean, you've got probably a Cracker Barrel out here on the interstate. And one of the big problems in the South now is, I think that Southerners sort of are worried about in a way is like the usurpation of the culture itself, and it's becoming sort of inauthentic before their eyes as it becomes manufactured and moved. But it's very mm-hmm. present.
Yeah.
I mean, here you have something called there's a Logan's Roadhouse, and then right down the way is a Roadhouse. And the manufacturers of Logan's Roadhouse have made it look exactly like the authentic thing there. And so that kind of expression of Southern culture is now sort of sweeping the country, whereas sort of Midwestern culture, I mean, how could that happen? I mean, that would be an interesting question.
Hmm, I don't know. Ours, too, I think, is we're under the same kind of pressures. I think
uh-huh.
maybe we're not as... aware of them.
Uh-huh.
But if you, there's a story, you know, the census was done and our population here grew a little bit, modest growth. In Champaign, the population remained the same roughly in Urbana. But despite the modest growth in population, the urban areas are moving,
mm-hmm.
going outward.
Yeah, still spreading out.
Yeah. Yeah, much greater than
yeah.
the growth in population
yeah.
you'd guess from that. And then at the same time, what's on the periphery now is anywhere USA kind of stuff.
Right, that's true. And that is true. There is that. Yeah, a friend of mine lives in Indianapolis, and I went to school in Indianapolis as well, and I recently flew in there, and Indianapolis was called Naptown, Indianapolis, but it was Naptown as well. It was sleepy. It was not, and then I came in, and it was just booming, and that same type of sort of donut structure was happening, and I said to Susan, I said, what's going on here? And without missing a beat, she said, Viagra money. Or not Viagra, Prozac money, because Lilly is there. And so there was all of this money, and what, of course, they invested in was that very sort of homogenous culture as opposed to, you know, an indigenous culture, whatever there was of it. I mean,
Maybe it's harder for Midwesterners, for us to recognize our culture because it's always been kind of homogenous.
Yeah.
Except from place to place. I mean, you think about my hometown is Rockford, Illinois, and on one side of the river, one side of the Rock River, Italian Americans settled. On the east side of the river, Swedish Americans and Scandinavians mm-hmm. settled. But now that's all, you know, becoming mixed up
yeah.
as well. But there's still strong touches of that. But generally speaking, when you think about the Midwest, you do sort of think about Jell-O and
right
you know,
and mayonnaise,
yeah, white bread,
yeah, the. But I think that's just it. That I mean, again, that has to do with movement, because you're talking about a sort of immigrant influx. But it's like the high tide. It only had one wave. Growing up in Fort Wayne, my family's Italian. Only one wave. That generation, my grandfather's generation, they moved all the way across the country. They all settled at the same time, and that was it. Whereas in Syracuse, when I lived there. The Italian community was still, there would be new influxes of, or in Baltimore, the Greek community still has immigrants, you know, from the same villages filling up the places of that, to give that kind of feel. But no, it does immediately get, and that's another interesting contrast about Iowa. You would, each town would have that initial thing, and it had sort of, I guess decayed in some way from that, but you know you could tell it was a Czech town or an Irish town or the Dutch Reform, and yet just like every kind of immigrant experience, all of a sudden you could go two ways: either you sort of become more German than the German you are, or you have sort of strange residue left over from. You know, from that time, maybe one thing, the one festival, and it becomes a sort of weird kind of echo that in some cases, maybe you even forget why it is mm-hmm. you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting as well.
Yeah. Wonderful essay in the book, The Flatness, about, I believe it's titled Manufacturing Place. And I want to talk about the Midwest as being, you know, we spent quite a bit of time talking about it being an agricultural place,
yeah.
but it's also a place of industry. And thinking back to my hometown, Essex Wire
mm-hmm.
had
a plant there.
Uh-huh. I think they might still mm-hmm. have a plant there. But the interesting thing about that for me when I was growing up, by the time I was able to get over to the side of town on my own where Essex Wire and other manufacturers.
Was it on the east side?
No, it was on the west side.
Really? Oh, that's unusual.
I know. I'm reading your essay. Folks in Fort Wayne were much smarter. They put industry on the east side so that, you know, you wouldn't be downwind.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, that plant physically hums.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
But talk with us about going to work with your father and the switching room.
Yeah, my dad was a switchman, and this was in the time before the electronic switchers. They were actual mechanical switchers, and they the mechanical switches actually replaced the operator who sat at a table and spliced in the wires. These mechanic things did it, you know, as you dialed. And I always, when I read from this essay, I always look out at the audience now and realize that more and more people in the audience, of course, have never dialed the phone, even though they still say they dial. But you can probably remember when you dialed, you could actually hear the switch. Sometime it would go sort of tick, and that was his job, to maintain those, all those wires, hundreds and thousands of wires. And I would go and just see these things, rows and rows and rows and rows of these switches that were always clicking as people were dialing and hanging up. And as they say in the essay, he was in the switch room when Kennedy was shot, and he wasn't listening to the radio or anything, but he knew something happened, because all of a sudden all the usual clicks and stutters just began to go wild as people began to call each other. And what he could do was, actually, there's this little instrument called a butt in, and he took the butt in, which is a handheld phone with some alligator clips, and butt into a conversation, and that's how he learned that what was going on, and he could piece it together through all these thousands of conversations. Mm-hmm. So switches are interesting to me then, especially connected to the fact that Fort Wayne, when I was growing up, one of the myths of Fort Wayne was that we were seventh on Hitler's bombing list. And I think that's a good Midwestern thing, because it's polite. It's not like we said we were third on the list, because no one would believe that. But seventh, you know, it is good enough. But it also is that good Midwestern thing, is that we're important enough to be destroyed. It's that weird, I think, modesty.
Well, we grew up with that in Rockford.
Of course.
Well, it wasn't Hitler. It was the Cold War.
Oh, the Cold War. Everybody was going to be... Why were you going to be bombed?
Yeah.
Did they have a sort of reason for it?
Oh, because there's so much manufacturing.
Yes,
you know,
at
one time, Rockford was the tool and die capital of the world.
Right. And Fort Wayne was the wire and die capital of the world. So, of course, that was strategic. We were up there. And so I just love that. See, we are important. We're important enough to be wiped out in the first wave.
Maybe that's why some of us really get excited about the weather here, too. You know? It's like, we're going to get wiped out by this storm or that
storm.
Yes,
and our pet weather, which is the tornado. Though in Alabama, that's quite prevalent there as well.
Really?
Yeah, we had a bad tornado this last winter.
I mean,
but it starts earlier there.
Yeah.
And it moves up, the corridor moves up the country, just like the daffodils.
Yeah. So. Well, have you seen the pet tornado?
Have I seen it? I've seen it once. And what was interesting about the last thing in Tuscaloosa is, now with all the cell phone towers,
They've
all the weather stations there have put cameras on those towers. And so this one, and it was a big one, was coming sort of right toward my house, but I couldn't pull myself away to go to the safe place because it was there on camera. And they had a sort of triangulation, because of the cells, of viewing this tornado in real time.
Mm.
It was fascinating.
Well, what I'm talking about in terms of the pet tornado is this little thing in a jar that you swirl.
Oh, you mean like using an old soda jar and getting the vortex going?
Getting the vortex going. Yeah, the pet tornado.
I like that.
Like the pet rock.
Yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're drawing here down on our time. Anything else we should talk about before you have to wrap up? Being in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, noting your feeling for place and for story, is Alabama having an impact on what you're writing?
In a little ways. When I moved there, they said something very interesting. I'll tell you two interesting things. First, they said, to understand the South, you have to understand the four biggest funerals in its history. And I said, okay, who were they? And they said, Jefferson Davis, Martin Luther King, Elvis, and Bear Bryant. So as a sort of triangulation or reticulation, it's a pretty good map, I think, of civil rights, civil war, music, and football. I think that does it.
Yeah. Well, also thinking, going back to where we started in our conversation this afternoon, thinking about that course on contemporary rural and agricultural literature.
Yeah, none of that Steinbeck stuff.
Just thinking about it, though, I mean, think of all the writers that, you know, we do have here.
But oh, yeah.
They are kind of invisible. Jane Smiley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked with Jane at Iowa State.
Wendell Berry, Jane Hamilton.
Richard Rhodes, if you know Richard Rhodes' work, he's famous for this book on the atomic bomb, but grew up on a farm in Missouri. He's written extensively a wonderful book called The Inland Ground, Evocations of the American Middle West. I use Don Lee's book of poetry, The Porcine Canticles, Mary Swander, Carol Bly's Letters from the Country. It was an amazingly rich, Jim Heinen's book. Do you know the man who kept cigars in his cap? In one-room schoolhouse about growing up on farms in western Iowa. So an amazingly rich literature.
Yeah. Boy, I'm going to have to go back and get the tape of this conversation and write down some of these things and go look for these books now.
Yeah.
Michael Martone, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.